Good evening and welcome to Atlantic Tales on Clare FM. On today's show, we meet some of the people behind Ireland's first charity air ambulance service. Irish Community Rapid Response was established in 2008 as a ground service with volunteers supporting local communities in times of emergency. Building on that experience, with a network of volunteer doctors and rapid response vehicles, Irish Community Air Ambulance successfully launched Ireland's first charity-funded air ambulance service on the 30th of July 2019. Based in Rathcoole in North Cork, the helicopter uses the call sign HeliMed92 and is a declared asset of the National Ambulance Service, responding to the most serious trauma and medical emergencies when required. In its first 12 months of operation, crews responded to almost 500 missions. County Clare ranks third behind Cork and Kerry as the county where the air ambulance responds to the most emergencies. The Helicopter Emergency Medical Service, or HEMS model, is very popular in the UK, where there are several charity air ambulance services, some operating multiple helicopters. However, this is a new concept to Ireland. Michal Sheridan is CEO of Irish Community Air Ambulance and explained to me how it all started as a ground-based emergency medical service.
This organisation kind of grew out of West Cork, so people may be familiar from even just social media with Dr. Jason and West Cork Rapid Response. Then there's also Hugh Doran and East Cork Rapid Response, and then the same people were kind of involved in setting up Wicklow Rapid Response. Our ground services, currently we would have 10 vehicles on the road. Some of those are staffed by what we would call critical care doctors. So doctors who are working day-to-day in emergency departments, who are seeing trauma on a day-to-day basis, on an hour-by-hour basis, and then after hours are responding voluntarily to calls in their community. So those doctors, so particularly where we would have them that geographically remote areas, for example, Dr. Jerry Lane in Letterkenny, Dr. Jason Horn in Mayo. We're also delighted later on this year that a lady called Dr. Lisa Cunningham is going to join that team effectively, and she'll be based in Ballina in Mayo, working in the same hospital as Jason Horn. But effectively, what that means, we'll have two rapid response critical care doctors on the ground in Mayo, and you know, Mayo is parts of it are quite remote. And then in some of our cars in Dublin, and then in one in North Cork and one in Waterford, we have GPs who are in cars as well. But the critical care doctor model is one that we're really excited about. We have some young new doctors going into Dublin as well, who are working in the hospitals in Dublin, ambitious, driven doctors, young guys in their 20s, young ladies in their 30s who want to do something, who have the time because they're maybe they don't have the same commitments as those with children and families, but we're very excited about that. And one of the things that people will know who've been following the organisations is very recently we changed our name from Irish Community Rapid Response to Irish Community Air Ambulance. And that doesn't mean that we're just focusing in the air. What it means is that we're saying that the cars on the ground will be an extension of the air ambulance. They'll be staffed by either critical care doctors or advanced paramedics or critical care paramedics. They'll have the same type of equipment as would be in the helicopter. And what we're just saying is, in areas where we currently don't provide a service, or possibly where you're on the outer fringes of our ability to reach you, maybe we're 35 minutes flight, that what we want to try to do is have a critical care doctor who's 10, 15 minutes away from you that can get to you first, or get to you along with the National Ambulance Service road crew and start to work on the patient. And then if they need to be treated, the guys arrive in the heli. And if the patient then needs to be transferred, obviously, and they're in an area that makes it better for them to travel by air, then that's obviously what we do. We'll bring them to the best hospital for what is happening to them, not necessarily their nearest.
The National Ambulance Service, in conjunction with the Irish Air Corps and the Department of Defence, launched Ireland's Emergency Aeromedical Service in 2012. The service, based in Athlone, is staffed by an Irish Air Corps flight crew and a National Ambulance Service advanced paramedic. The Irish Coast Guard also provides additional HEMS support to the primary aircraft using their search and rescue helicopters based at Shannon, Dublin, Sligo and Waterford. Irish Community Air Ambulance became a further extension of this, being formally declared an asset to the Emergency Air Medical Service. The air ambulance concept is still relatively new to Ireland.
The original concept of the air ambulance in Ireland, I think, came about almost in a kind of a typically Irish way, which is we are shutting down an emergency department in a local hospital. How do we address that? So we'll create an air ambulance service. You know, I think we and others in the area, I think really what's needed in Ireland is that somebody would take the country as a whole, look at the aeromedical assets that are available, and look at the types of roles that are needed in terms of offshore, like Coast Guard or ourselves or the Air Corps, and put a plan together. Because I think, you know, sometimes what can happen is we can just do things in a hodgepodge way. I think we want to be part of a formalised, structured approach to aeromedical services in Ireland. And, you know, as I said since the start, if we're called to be part of that, then absolutely we'd be part of it. Will we just set up a new base because we feel it's a good idea? Absolutely not. We want to be part of the long-term provision of a world-class aeromedical service to people in Ireland.
Charity air ambulances have been very popular and well-supported by the public in the UK for several years, despite previous attempts by other organisations to establish a similar charity-funded operation here. It was Irish Community Rapid Response who finally cleared all the hurdles and managed to launch Ireland's first charity-funded air ambulance service.
Yeah, absolutely new to Ireland. I think, you know, when you look at the UK, you look at England, Scotland, Wales, and even in the north, they've been up and running a number of years. And as you say, the concept of charity-funded air ambulance is new to Ireland here. I think the other thing as well that people may be surprised at, if you look at Wales, for example, the charity-funded air ambulance in Wales provides 4 helicopters. And actually, per head of population, that means they have an air ambulance for every 800,000 people. In the north of Ireland, for example, a population of 1.9 million people and one air ambulance, charity-funded. And then here in Ireland, one charity-funded air ambulance for 5 million people. So clearly, when we look at the UK and we look at the north of Ireland, with the history that they have and how developed they are, there is absolutely scope for it. And I think, as I've said all along since I started here in January, our ambition is to work with everybody to make sure that people in Ireland have access to air ambulance and ideally within 30 minutes, whether that's us or us with others, or whether in time government turn around and decide this is something they want to do as a government project and we've proven that it's needed, then, you know, we would support that. So really, the minute the call comes in, we actually become an asset to the National Ambulance Service.
The Irish Community Air Ambulance Service and its fundraising operation are based at Rathcoole Aerodrome in Knockcahill in County Cork, as Michal explains.
Yeah, so infrastructure, I suppose, and you'll know what you drove into our little car park at the front, and in front of you then you'll have seen two cabins, two pleasant looking wood cabins. One of them hosts, let's call it the charity side, so where our offices are, where our fundraisers are based, our administrators, and where our volunteer firefighters as well, where they would wait during the days, because we have to have them on duty here while the service is live. Next door to that then you'll have the crew cabin effectively. So within the crew cabin you have bathroom facilities, kitchen, a locker room with laundry, a quiet room, and then the large kind of ops room, let's call it, where the guys sit and wait to call to come in. So what you'll have noticed in there is maps and whiteboards and all those kind of things. And really that's just so when the call comes in, they're able to take down the details where the call is. And I think the most important message, even if people are listening to this, and it's the first thing the guys put up on the whiteboard when a call comes in, is the air code. So it's really important for people to know their air code, whether you're a child or an adult. It's just the most important thing. It does help the National Ambulance Service to inform the emergency services where to go to, and it certainly helps us in terms of getting there. So then next door to the large crew cabin you have a hangar that's built to store two helicopters. So today, for example, we just have our primary here. We're due to take delivery on the 14th of June this year of a new 109S. So the two helicopters, our primary and our backup, will be housed in our hangar. And then you'll see around fire extinguishers and a fire tender and bowsers with jet fuel in them. So, you know, we obviously have to make sure from a safety perspective that if there were to be an accident or an incident here at the base, that from a firefighting perspective, we're able to respond to that.
Irish Community Air Ambulance primarily covers the Munster area, but could be requested to respond to a call anywhere in Ireland. So how is the Rathcoole-based aircraft tasked? What's the procedure?
Yeah, so if you just take an example, this is what happened with the guys that are gone. They're gone to the Kanturk area of North Cork. Something has happened somebody. Somebody's ringing 999 or 112. They're getting through to the call centre in the National Ambulance Service. The call handler there is taking details from the individual. As I said, they'll take air codes, but an important thing that they'll do is they'll look for a mobile phone number just in case you get cut off. So they'll then start to ask about whether it's you yourself, you've had an injury but you're able to call, or somebody who's a bystander or a family member. They'll start to take down obviously the important details: phone number, name, location, air code, all those kind of things. Then it's starting to ask set questions that help them to then move through the system to look to see, okay, well, what is the issue? What do we need? And then they'll look and see the available assets, and they'll look and see, okay, well, we have a road ambulance that's 20 miles away. We have a rapid response doctor, for example, who's 15 minutes away. And we also have the air ambulance if we feel that it's needed. So the tasking comes from the National Ambulance Service, from NEOC and the call centre there. It comes to the crew cabin here. And this morning, for example, it would have been Paul Trainer, who you've spoken to. Paul would take the call, take down the details. And then, as you saw earlier, actually, when they were tasking, everybody goes into the, everybody has a job. So Ian, the pilot's job is go get the heli ready, start turning it on so that, as you saw, probably in under 3 minutes, the guys were in the air. So that's really how it works. What would also happen is earlier this morning, because it might just, some people maybe don't know this little piece of it. Sometimes they're tasked. So if you have a road traffic collision and it's a bystander or another motorist who has seen somebody turn the car over into a ditch, they're then ringing 999. And they're trying as best they can to help the National Ambulance Service understand what's happening. But for example, this morning, a tasking to a road traffic collision, car was overturned. There were concerns about getting the driver out of the car. We left here, so we were tasked en route. And then obviously when local fire services were on scene, they were able to get the individual out of the car, realise that they weren't as injured maybe as people would have first worried about. And obviously then we're stood down. So that can happen sometimes. And sometimes we're stood down overseen. A few weeks ago, there was an RTC, and one of the individuals in the RTC was critically injured and passed away at scene. We would have been en route. So we get turned down overhead again because there is no need for us to be there, and sadly somebody has passed away.
So how busy has HeliMed 92 been since it commenced operations?
So last year, for example, so 2020, across the 12 months, we were tasked 490 times. This year so far, from January to the end of May, we were tasked 230 times. And when you factor in that the average cost of every tasking is €3,500. So this year alone, our costs, what we've spent so far, is about €800,000. And you can see then, therefore, actually, if the year continues, we're probably looking at a cost of about €1.6 million, even, rather than the €1.55 million we budgeted for. The other thing that kind of changes the implications in terms of our funding is, so our costs are broken down very simply for the heli. There's our lease cost, there's our flying hour charge, and then there's our fuel costs. And what we are starting to see, and we, as always, will not stop bringing people where they need to go to, but one of the things that is now happening because of the new trauma network is that if you have a child who's injured, severely injured, and needs to get to the best centre possible for what has happened to them, that could be, as happened last weekend, that could be a child in a stall who's in an RTC who's hit by a car, and that child has to go to Temple Street. So that means that we are bringing that child to Dublin. Now, we will bring kids to Dublin all day, every day, if that's what's required. But what it does do is it does then start to cost us that extra money. And that is really why fundraising, funding, corporate support, philanthropy is and will be more important than ever in the future.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear how County Clare is one of the busiest areas for taskings for the Irish Community Air Ambulance crews, and we'll meet more of those involved in the charity-funded operation.
Atlantic Tales on Clare FM, in association with Nolo Loughlin Insurance Services, for all your general insurance and life assurance needs. Call Noel 086 845 9912. Visit o'loughlinfinancial.ie.
Shannon, good afternoon. HeliMed 92 Alpha with you.
HeliMed 92 Alpha, information go.
92 Alpha, just airborne out of Rathcoole en route to Ennis Diamond, not above 2,000 feet with three on board. Estimating Ennis Diamond in approximately 2-4 minutes.
On the hour for Ennis Diamond, 1400 is copy, thank you, and H1009 hectopascal. Will that bring you through?
Today we're in Rathcoole in North Cork to meet some of the people behind Ireland's first charity air ambulance service. Established in 2019, Irish Community Air Ambulance has responded to almost 1,000 calls in its first 22 months of operation. One of the busiest counties for the service to attend emergency calls is Clare, as CEO Michal Sheridan explains.
If you look at our tasking numbers for last year, for example, Cork, Kerry just are obviously one and two, geographically quite close, remote areas, you know, West Cork, places in Kerry like Aries and Waterville. But again, people may not be aware of the fact that our third busiest tasking county is County Clare. primarily where, if I was to think of a map of County Clare and remember the places we've been to Ballyvaughan for farming accidents. There are a lot of calls come in for places like Kilkee, Kilrush, up along the coast, Liscannor, Lahinch, places like Broadford. So really we have been. I mean, it kind of surprised me, I think, when I started in terms of the amount of travel. And I think really why Clare is probably one of our busier tasking counties. If you drew a line from Racoole here straight up to Ballyvaughan or to the coast of County Clare, it's really a straight line. You know, we're 10 minutes here from Tarbert, if even. So we're in parts of Clare along the coast in 20, 25 minutes. What would happen, a lot of those patients really just depending. So if I remember the case in Ballyvaughan, that patient was transferred to University Hospital College Galway. But again, we're landing quite frequently as well at the pad in University Hospital Limerick. So they would be where we would bring people. But obviously, as I said earlier, now with the new trauma network starting up and the new protocols, it's highly possible that if somebody has a traumatic injury or things like severe burns, then they're going to Dublin. So the centre for burns in the country is St James's. So people are then being brought to those places. We'll be bringing them. So again, that it's that thing of you may end up bypassing your local hospital, but really the key at that stage is if you're critically injured enough or medically unwell enough, then you're going to the best place, not the nearest place.
Shannon, good day. Helimet 92 Alpha back with you. Low level airborne by Kilkee.
Helimet 92 Alpha, Shannon information, good day again. QNH 9 or 7 hectopascals, go ahead.
997 just airborne out of Kilkee and routing into Limerick Hospital. 4 on board, not above 1,000 feet. Estimating Limerick Hospital in about 1:00.
In 2018, Irish Community Rapid Response signed a contract with UK-based Sloan Helicopters to provide an aircraft to operate Ireland's first charity-funded air ambulance service. Ian Hempley is a Helicopter Emergency Medical Service, or HEMS, pilot, currently based with Irish Community Air Ambulance in Cork. So how did Ian get involved in aviation and flying as a HEMS pilot?
Yeah, so for me, definitely childhood dream. I have always thought about sort of fixed-wing flying, maybe initially. Did a little bit at school, did a little bit sort of in the air cadets. And then around, I guess, I was in my sort of early 30s, I got bought a trial lesson in a helicopter. And I realised that's were the bits I was missing. That ticked all the boxes for me. So, it kind of went from there. I realised, certainly from the civilian world, doing it yourself privately is expensive. So I realised early on that if I was going to do it, I had to do it properly, become a commercial pilot and do it for a living, which I wanted to do anyway, but it was just finding the right sort of motivation and time to do it. But I'm glad I did.
And what about the training then? How much is involved in that in terms of time? And is it a protracted...
It can be. Certainly, I did it. I did it in about 2 years, which I think is sort of average to sort of quick. You have to do your PPL, private pilot's license, helicopter first, a little bit of hour building, do some more exams, your commercial pilot's helicopter license, and then once you've qualified, you then start the very long process of getting experience in order to be able to do worthwhile jobs. Personally, I started as an instructor, so I taught people how to fly, built a bit of experience that way, and then was fortunate enough to be involved in various different companies doing commercial air transport and utility work before I finally ended up in the HEMS environment, the EMS environment.
You did the whole thing of the utility work, which I presume means checking power cables and all
Correct,
of thing, flying passengers as well.
Yes.
And how did the whole HEMS thing come? Was this sort of a natural progression, the next step?
It was something I was aiming towards, but again, you have to find an opportunity or be presented with an opportunity. In my case, I was lucky enough. I was doing my instrument rating with a company called Sloan Helicopters in the UK. They are a HEMS provider for the charity called the Air Ambulance Service, and I was lucky enough to get involved with them. I then went to a company called Babcock, and I was a touring pilot with them, doing HEMS for, I believe they have like 8 to 10 charities in the UK they look after. So my role was to go and support those bases when they needed it, or they needed a relief pilot. And then I left them, and I'm now back with Sloan as a what we describe as a freelancer. So I fill in when they need somebody and get sent to wherever it is they need it, Ireland, Coventry, or the East Midlands Airport in the UK.
What about the aircraft you've flown then? When you're a trainee pilot, do you start in a certain type of aircraft and work through?
Yes, and it's down to expense, basically. So in the UK, they do a lot of training in something called a Robinson 22, which is a piston-engined aircraft. I actually started in another piston aircraft called a Hughes 300, or a Schweitzer, as it was known, and that's purely down to cost. Helicopters, learning to fly, is about half as much, again, as fixed wing. But even so, that's even on pistons. Yep. You know, when you start getting into turbine engine helicopters or twin engine helicopters, it becomes very, very expensive. So, you know, you sort of have to do this progression of piston to keep the cost down. Then once you've got a commercial license, hopefully somebody would pay for you to have your rating on a bigger aircraft. And then you build your experience and hours that way.
So the expense is one side of it, but how do the skills transfer from different aircraft to different aircraft?
Very much a helicopter is a helicopter. However, the systems get more complicated the bigger the aircraft is, and there are flight profiles which are different. But any helicopter pilot, I reckon, probably could get in a helicopter. The controls are very similar. They will do similar things. There is a slight complication in respect of some makes the rotor system, main rotor system, spins anti-clockwise, and in some makes it spins clockwise. That has an effect on which sort of pedal you use for anti-torque capability. But to be honest with you, yeah, any helicopter pilot can get in any aircraft and fly it. The more experience you have, the better. It's a bit like getting in a different car. You know, the more comfortable you are with it, the easier it is to learn about the particular peculiarities of the car. But the way the training goes, you can't just jump in an aircraft. You know, you have to do a type rating course. You have to pass a skills test on that. And then we have recurrent training every 12 months or every 6 months, depending as well.
Tell me about this particular aircraft. This is an Augusta Westland 109.
Correct, yes. This current one is the E variant. There are three variants of 109, ES and SP. They've been around a fair while now. It's described as a light twin. It has a twin turbine engined, maximum forward speed or maximum airspeed of around 158 knots, depending on conditions, and a range of approximately 2 hours, depending on your payload. It's obviously got an undercarriage, which is unusual for a helicopter. Most have fixed skids. This one has the undercarriage that gives it the speed advantage. With the three crew we have today, I've got a good hour and 40 minutes with a half hour reserve if I need to do what we need to do. Augusta Westland, also known as the Leonardo, it's an Italian helicopter, so they say it's a beautiful helicopter. But no, it's a very, very capable aircraft, particularly for this role. I've flown both EC-135s, which is a Eurocopter in the HEMS role. Again, another capable aircraft, and obviously the AW109, which again is very, very capable on the HEMS role.
So when you're here at the base then, Ian, on a given day, you don't know what's ahead of you?
No.
But what tasks would you have to carry out in preparation for a day's flying?
So the first thing I'd do is come in. I would initially check all the weather to make sure it's suitable to do that. I'd also check what we call NOTAMs, which is Notice to Airmen. So they would give us any warnings of airspace closures, drone activity, fuel availability, all that sort of thing. I would look at the weight and balance calculations for the day, because it's very much dependent on outside air temperature, the day's pressure, the weight we're carrying. So I have to do calculations to ensure that we can maintain our requirements for that. I would then inspect the aircraft. So I'd give it a... Sorry, excuse me.
Okay. Ian just got called away. It looks like that the helicopter may be tasked, so we'll have to wait and see.
Med 92 Alpha, go ahead.
92 Alpha, Augusta 193 on board. We've just lifted from last call. Heading to North Camp Turk. I'm anticipating a journey time of about 2.5 minutes.
Heading Med 92 Alpha, that's copy. Shannon Q, H1023, X Pascal, support to Camp Turk.
1023 and Wilco speaking shortly, 9 to Alpha.
Ready to jump into action when HeliMed 92 reaches a scene is a National Ambulance Service advanced paramedic. As an advanced paramedic specially trained in advanced life support skills, Paul Trainer works with Irish Community Air Ambulance. He has also been a familiar face on the popular television programme Paramedics. Where did Paul's interest in the ambulance service and HEMS come from?
I was always kind of geared towards the fire service. My dad was in the retained fire service in Kilkenny for 40 years, so I grew up around the corner from the fire station and probably grew up in the fire station, was often dropped off when his beeper went off and he had to go for a call. We got left in the control room, except my brother, until mother could come and pick us up. So I was always grew up around the emergency services. And then as I got a little bit older and became more aware of some of the work that the fire service was doing around Kilkenny, got an interest in kind of the road traffic collision, the rescue stuff, seeing the medical side of that, and could see the ambulance service starting to evolve from essentially the ambulance drivers with the nurse going out to collect the patient to emergency medical technicians on it, which is kind of around the time in 2002 where I joined the ambulance service, applied for a number of places. There was no national ambulance service then, it was all the regional health boards. So I threw my name into the hat in a couple of places, ended up getting it in Cork, and close to 20 years later, I'm still here.
In terms of the training, how tough was that starting out?
The initial EMT training I'd done was tough because I had no clue what I was letting myself in for. But in hindsight, it probably actually wasn't particularly difficult. The amount of medications and interventions that we could do were very limited back then in 02. But very soon after I started, there was lots of talk of EMTA, which was the Emergency Medical Technician Advanced, as it was called back then. And that was the forerunner of what we now call the advanced paramedics. And I was lucky enough in 2006, so relatively soon after I started, I got onto one of the first advanced paramedic courses to be run. That was significantly tougher than the initial EMT one. There was a lot more academic side to it, a huge amount more medications, interventions, and a lot of underpinning knowledge that we had to learn on anatomy and physiology. And again, that was still very new. We were still finding our feet as advanced paramedics as to where we were going to fit into the entire ambulance service. And yeah, we kind of took it from there.
Having originally been more interested in the fire service because of his father's connection there, did Paul appreciate what was ahead of him when he decided to train and pursue a career as a paramedic?
Looking back at it now, no, I probably didn't. At the time, I'm sure I thought that I knew exactly what this would entail. But working on the road as a paramedic, it's much more varied than I would have thought it was. You see the TV programs and they show all the dramatic stuff, the cardiac arrest and the road traffic collisions, but I spent a lot of time working. I've worked in all the ambulance stations in Cork over the years, and a lot of time in Cork City, and you're dealing with a lot more social stuff, a lot more elderly patients than you would ever see on the TV shows. A lot of people who don't know who to call, so they end up calling an ambulance for some kind of social medical reason, and you know they can't get their GP, they can't get Care Doc or South Doc or Shannon Doc, and they end up calling an ambulance, and you don't really have a skill set or training for that. Now the ambulance service has moved on in that they're training community paramedics to deal with more lower acuity problems within the community, but I've kind of moved away over the years from that type of stuff to the aeromedical or the helicopters, which I've been involved in now since 2013.
And the Emergency Air Medical Service in 2012, when that started first, this was new to Ireland. We didn't have an air ambulance service. I know that the Coast Guard could do HEMS calls and so forth, but to have a dedicated air ambulance service in Ireland in 2012, but an absolutely essential service almost 10 years later.
Yeah, I actually can't imagine how we were managing even back, you know, prior to EAS or the Emergency Air Medical Service starting in Athlone. And now the expansion of a similar service in the southwest. But to look back and think of how we were managing those critically ill and injured patients in very rural and remote areas without the advent of a helicopter service coming to them and bringing the most, you know, the highest level of care that we have within the ambulance service is an advanced paramedic. So both of the services now are bringing that, and we're learning from each other. So while the two services are operated by different aircraft providers, so we have the Irish Air Corps and Irish Community Air Ambulance in the southwest, the advanced paramedics on board are National Ambulance Service. So we have shared learning between the two stations, where if we have an interesting call, we're on to them and vice versa. And as I said, for lots of places. I can't imagine how we manage without it.
Being on the air ambulance, did that take particular training? Aside from your medical AP training, was there other additional training you had to go through to work on a helicopter?
So there's probably two strands to that. So there's with the Air Corps 112 in Athlone, we were brought up to Baldonnell and we were put through aviation specific training with the Air Corps. So what we would need to do to integrate as part of one of their crews, what we would need to know about what that crew is undertaking to get the aircraft into the air, into the scene and stuff like that. And then we had to do over time, not necessarily initially, but we started to do more specific medical training for some of the situations that we were encountering in order to sedate a patient that we need to take on the aircraft. And even things like when we were based in Athlone, we could go anywhere in the country and learning what services hospitals can provide for various patients. So when you go to a patient with a helicopter, you're not necessarily going to the nearest hospital. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you do. Sometimes if you're out in Clifton or if you're down in Loop Head, maybe you'll come back to Galway or come back to Limerick, you know, depending. But not necessarily. We could be in Carrigaholt and take a patient to Cork because the condition that the patient has or the injuries that they have are best treated in CUH or something like that. So, but a lot of that we only learned as we were developing. We didn't necessarily know that day one. That's something that we developed as we went along. When we came down, or when I started in on the service here, it was a little bit different in that we were in Athlone. The Augusta Westland 139, as operated by the Air Corps, has two pilots and a crewman in the back and a National Ambulance Service advanced paramedic. So up there, a lot of your work is on the way to the call is doing the communications with the National Ambulance Service Control Centre, liaising with the pilot about the appropriateness maybe of continuing the call or possibly standing down or diverting to a different call. Whereas down here, the Augusta 109 that we have is operated as a single pilot, and all of the staff members here are trained up as technical crew members. So when we leave here on a call, there's a National Ambulance Service practitioner sitting next to the pilot, and we're doing a lot of their navigation, a lot of the what we call widening their bandwidth by we're changing radio channels in the cockpit for them. We're watching out for obstacles. We're watching out for waypoints. We're filling in bits of information that they might miss if they've switched radio channels from the National Ambulance Service 1 to ATC and stuff like that. When we get overhead, we're very much involved in landing site selection, making sure it's appropriate, it's the right size, looking out for obstacles. If the stuff that we can't see, requesting maybe to go around and have another look at it from a different angle and stuff like that. So we're very much involved in the aviation side of things here, and then once we land we click back into our medical role to a point. So like today we have two advanced paramedics on the aircraft. One of those APs will be specifically looking after the patient and will be the clinical lead between the crew, and then the other one will do some patient care but also be involved in getting the aircraft ready, liaising with the pilot, making phone calls to the control center or radio messages. So we have very specific roles. You might have seen there when we were coming back from that call, so I was sitting in the front next to the pilot. So on the way out to that call earlier, I was doing the navigating, the communications with the control center, advising the pilot what we were likely to encounter when we get there, watching out for the various waypoints along the way and different terrain and obstacles. So it's half of our work here is more aviation specific.
Halimed 92 Alpha.
Halimed 92 Alpha, Sean.
Yeah, just a foot down into the heads. We are heading back toward Rathcoole again, no higher than 900 feet, 1022. Estimating time to Rathcoole about 05 minutes.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear more about the work of an advanced paramedic working with Ireland's first charity air ambulance service and how the operation is funded.
Atlantic Tales on Clare FM, in association with Nolo Loughlin Insurance Services, for all your general insurance and life assurance needs. Call Noel 086 845 9912. Visit o'loughlinfinancial.ie.
Welcome back to the programme. Today we're in Rathcoole in North Cork to meet some of the people behind Ireland's first charity air ambulance service. Paul Traynor has been working with the National Ambulance Service for almost 20 years. He is now one of the advanced paramedics working with the Irish Community Air Ambulance. So what does Paul do when he arrives at the base in Rathcoole for a shift?
No, every day is different here, and no more than when you go into an ambulance station. Some days are busy, some days you think you have the sense going in, oh, it's going to be busy today, and it turns out not to be. The first hour of the morning here is very busy regardless, because we're getting all the equipment onto the aircraft, we're doing all our pre-shift checks. The pilot is checking the aircraft, there's fuel checks to be done, the aircraft has to be pulled out. Then we have to do our morning brief, which is can take up to at least a half an hour. We're going through the weather for the region, the weather nationally, in case we end up getting sent out of our kind of normal area of operations, which would be Munster, but we do end up in Wexford and Offaly and Galway and places. So we need to have a good overview of the weather. We check things like NOTAMs, which is the notice to airmen issued by the Irish Aviation Authority for various airport closures or maybe drone activity or parachuting. We need to be aware of where they are, because if we get a call somewhere and we're heading in that direction and concentrating on what we're doing, we need to make sure we're not going to end up in a danger area or where there's other activity that wouldn't normally be there. The maintenance of the aircraft is considered part of the morning brief. All of our equipment, PPE, how we're all feeling. We have a little bit of a moment where everyone kind of declares, I was tired last night, or I, you know, have a bit of a toothache or whatever. You know, we all need to make sure that if somebody is 99%, that we're aware of it on the day. But generally, all of us here, if you're not 100%, we're ringing for a swap, or we move the shifts around, because, as you said, when the phone rings here, it can be full on. You know, sometimes it turns out not to be as bad as we initially were given. Like that call was for road traffic collision with entrapment. We were just overhead, and it turned out not to be. Once resources got on scene, that the information that was initially given, it wasn't as serious, so we were able to stand down and come back, and that's fine. We would rather crews be looking at us than looking for us.
Exactly. As you say, Paul, every day is different, and you could end up anywhere to any sort of a call. Is there a certain difficulty attached to going to certain types of calls?
There's certain calls, I suppose, that will affect different people in different ways. So there's pediatric calls are always difficult, but for me they became more difficult when I became a father. And then all of a sudden, like, I remember when my oldest, was only a couple of months old, going on a ground ambulance, going to a very, very difficult pediatric call, a really tragic incident. And that hit me more than all of the pediatric calls I'd done in the preceding years, because I was now looking at it in a different way. But it only affected me after the call. When you're doing the call, we're all, as much as possible, on our, you know, game faces on. We need to get it done. We know what to do. We know what needs to be done. We're all kind of conscious that there is time after the call to be affected by it. You know, I don't think I've ever seen anyone in the National Ambulance Service go to a call and go, oh God, I can't do this, and walk out. You do have a bit of a kind of a shield up when you're going to them. You have to, because it's my job to look after people who have become very sick or very seriously injured, and they don't want me falling apart. There's times when you go home afterwards and, you know, you're out for a walk with the dog a couple of days later and you find yourself thinking about it, and then you realise, yeah, this is after getting in on me a little bit more than some other call for whatever reason. And then there's calls that you expect that they'll get in on you, or, you know, that they'll trouble you, and they don't, which is good. And then some other call that you don't expect it to trouble you does, yes, you know, for some reason.
In the UK, charity air ambulances have been hugely successful, with some services operating multiple helicopters. How does the UK operation compare to what's happening in Ireland? And is it a model to build on here?
So the UK would have, a county like Cork would have probably two air ambulances for the geographical region. Now, obviously, they have much denser population than we do. But a lot of it, I think a big difference is people see the helicopter in Ireland as a mode of transport, and we often use it as a mode of transport to get a patient from A to B or from the scene to the hospital, where in the UK it's considered more of getting the people to the patient. So they're getting a medical team of either critical care paramedics or a doctor with a critical care paramedic to the patient first, and worry about
transport later.
Worry about treating them first and worry about transporting them afterwards, where I think here at the moment we're still in the transport phase, that if people see a helicopter coming, it's coming to transport you. A lot of the calls we do here, we end up not transporting patients. So we do a lot of cardiac arrest calls where we can actually be at scene either before or very quickly after the first ambulance gets there. And in some of the rural situations, in 15 minutes from leaving here, we can be at the scene of a cardiac arrest where the nearest ambulance is still a distance away. And we may not end up transporting that patient. We will certainly treat them to the fullest of our ability and training at the scene, but for various reasons that patient may not be transported either from the scene at all or with us. And then we go clear and we're available then for another call. So I think that's the big difference in the UK, is the people see the helicopter as bringing the medical team to them, whereas here it's bringing you away from the scene. And I think in Ireland, I don't think we'll ever get away from the transport bit because we're very rural. You know, West Clare, West Cork, West Kerry, not necessarily all the rural places are west, but
yeah,
there are places that are a long way from the hospital. So what we're doing here really is combining getting an advanced paramedic or an advanced paramedic team to the patient and then treating them, assessing their suitability for a different hospital other than the local one, and then using the aircraft as the mode of transport to get them back.
What about the equipment Paul carries on the air ambulance, and is it difficult working in the confined space of a helicopter?
Not really. While it looks a little bit smaller, we actually carry essentially everything that you would carry on board a regular emergency ambulance. So we have our ZOL monitor, defibrillator, 12D ECG, all the monitoring equipment that we need. We have our Lucas CPR compression device. We have multiple kit bags for basic life support, advanced life support. We carry a medications bag, control drugs, suction unit. The list goes on. Splints, vacuum mattresses, scoop stretchers. There's actually a boot in the back of it. So we have a certain amount of equipment in the cabin, and then we have a certain amount of equipment in the boot. It is cosy in the back, but the beauty of the 109 is we shut down at every single call that we go. 99.9% of the calls that we go to, we shut the aircraft down. We only need, in extreme circumstances, it can be landed in 30 metres by 30 metres, which is twice the size of the aircraft. And so we can get in quite close. We've landed at very critical incidents in people's back gardens. Now, not the back garden of your three-bed semi, but standalone houses in the countryside with decent back or front gardens. We've landed in that. We've landed on roads, laybys, lots of places like that. And we shut down. So by shutting down, it takes away a lot of the noise and the excitement of an aircraft arriving at a scene. As soon as we shut down, people forget that we're there.
Yeah.
So we can treat the patient at the scene. We can bring them over closer to the aircraft, finish off what we're doing. And basically when we put them in, it's continuity of care. So if we've intubated the patient and we're breathing for them, or if we've sedated them, or if we've given them very strong pain relief, it's the continuation of that. So we don't really start any new interventions in the back unless the patient had a significant deterioration where we needed maybe to put a needle in their chest to relieve pressure or tension building up or something like that. But generally, we're able to do all of our assessment and treatment next to the aircraft, put them in. It takes about 3 minutes to get into the air from when we start up, and about a minute to shut it down once we land. So it's very nimble. It can be got into very tight places, and the fact that we can shut it down, load the patient up, make sure everything is 100%, close up the doors, start up and leave.
National Ambulance Service and Irish Community Air Ambulance Advanced Paramedic Paul Trainer also featured in a TV programme called Paramedics. The programme has been credited with increasing the profile of the National Ambulance Service and the Emergency Air and Medical Service and making the public aware of what goes on behind the scenes in both operations.
Yeah, definitely, and I enjoy being part of the paramedic show on TV3. For years you would have seen things like you know, the Gardaí and the fire service are at an accident and somebody was taken to hospital. And that always kind of drives us a bit nuts because, like, there's a lot of work going on, goes on to get somebody from an accident or an incident to the hospital. And there's a lot of very important interventions, and the ambulance service is a very important part of the chain of healthcare. You know, while we're part of an emergency service, a lot of us see ourselves more as healthcare workers than emergency workers, if that makes sense. You know, because we're like the external arm of the hospital. So we're out there reaching out to these patients, looking after them in their homes or in their farms or on the side of the road, doing now interventions that would have only been done in the hospital, and then in direct communication with the hospital in a lot of cases, and bringing them into the emergency department or to the cardiac cath lab, or depending on the situation.
It does. The programmes, they do highlight the work of our emergency services, but it's also a good way of recruiting people because they know what they could be getting themselves in for.
Oh yeah, there's a recently, where I'm living in East Cork, a number of years ago I met a guy working behind the meat counter in the local SuperValu, and he said to me, "Oh, you're the guy from the TV show, I love that, da, da, da." And years later, only a couple of weeks ago, I met him as he was doing his pre-shift check in the local ambulance station as an intern paramedic. So he's gone from watching the TV show going, "God, I'd love to be doing that," and now he is doing it. So
how difficult, as a matter of interest, was it working with a camera crew, doing your job in front of the cameras?
It seemed like it was going to be very difficult. We were lucky in that when they were following us on the road, there was a crew. So there was a producer, a cameraman and a production assistant. But when they came on the aircraft, we could only take one person. So the producer actually had to become the cameraman. So we just had one person there Thankfully, he had a very small camera, so we didn't actually notice it a lot at the time. And he was a really good guy who embedded himself very easily with us, acknowledged that he was in an environment that most people don't get to experience, learned a lot about that before he ever started doing any filming. And by the time he started filming his on-calls, he was one of us at that point. He was the fifth member of the crew, essentially. Yes.
But you guys were you were concentrating on the job. You were doing your job. You weren't distracted.
No, and anything to do with aviation is very well briefed and trained and rehearsed, for want of a better word. And we have lots of checklists and lots of standard operating procedures. So we just continued as if he wasn't there.
Is working as an advanced paramedic a dream job for Paul? And what would he say to someone thinking about following in his footsteps?
I suppose it is. It's getting up at early hours in the morning in the winter and heading, I have an hour and 20 minutes commute up and back each day. Mightn't see him at all the time, but for me, yeah, certainly it's, if the time or when the time comes to move on from this, I'm not too sure what I'm going to do that'll match this. But for me, it's been the pinnacle of my career so far within the ambulance service. I suppose the only other thing that could come close to was qualifying as an advanced paramedic. So having that, learning those skills and having that qualification and building on those skills over the last 12 years, but to be able to combine the training, the qualification and the experience, put it with the aircraft has been something really special, coming up on 20 years in the job. And I won't say I've loved every minute of it, but I've loved more than I haven't. It's a really good job. It's interesting, it's varied, it can be monotonous. But like for anybody coming into it now, they will start into a 3-year full-time Bachelor of Science degree program through UCC. So they will be well trained, they will be paid as a trainee, they will come out of it after 3 years with a degree, and there is far more options now, and it's increasing at all times, to go into various different avenues of paramedic care. So we have community paramedics, we have critical care paramedics, we have the aeromedical side of things, and as the years go on, that's going to increase. There will be more opportunities for people. And there's guys and girls who have come into this job and decided that it wasn't for them and they've moved on to nursing or they've gone to do medicine. You know, not the majority, but there are people that do that. Mm-hmm. So it's a really good job. And if it's something that people are interested in, go for it. I never expected when I started as an EMT in Cork City back in 2002 that all these years later I'd be strapping into a helicopter to go off on a call. So,
Irish Community Air Ambulance receives no government funding. The service relies heavily on the fundraising efforts of its dedicated supporters to keep HeliMed 92 in the air, as CEO Micheál Sheridan explains.
So I think the challenge we have here is we're operating 22 months. The organisation before we took on the cost of the air ambulance was fundraising about €300,000 a year, and that was more than covering the costs. Then suddenly you bring a helicopter onto the base that's costing you €1.5 million a year. And what we're now realising is that we need the structures in place to be able to raise that kind of money. I think the one thing as well, maybe that would be helpful for people to understand, we're called the Irish Community Air Ambulance. I think some people then feel that because we're of the community that we actually are government funded. We're a charity funded operation. We currently get no government support. We have had conversations already with Minister Stephen Donnelly about that. The other thing that we've been doing is we've been engaging with our OCTIS members from the counties or the constituencies that we're operating in. So we've had conversations with our OCTIS members from Limerick and Cork, very positive meetings. We do need, for the next number of years, we are asking for some government support because of the fact that we're providing a service to the state and because we were set up just on the cusp of COVID, and that has really decimated any plans that there were for fundraising. We do have some really good support already coming in from some corporate partners and also from the community. And we expect when COVID restrictions start to lift that we'll start to see more what we would call gratitude fundraising, which is either people or families or communities where we have gone in to help somebody and get somebody out of a difficult situation. And every year there are lots more of those. So, you know, we really would be asking people to consider us, whether they're communities or individuals or companies. We really would be asking people to consider supporting us, particularly in the next couple of years. We're not just saying we want money from those that are wealthy. So if somebody's in a shop and they see one of our boxes on the retail counter and they've got a few pennies to spare, you know, we would like people to support that. The other thing as well that we've recently launched, and I'm sure they'll reach County Clare very soon, or even if people wanted to contact us, we actually now have managed to merge the old collection boxes that you'll see on a little retail counter, the box for the pennies. We've managed to merge those into an option where people can put their pennies in the box, or they can tap to donate using their mobile phone. So technology now has moved on so much that in the sticker on the lid of the box, there is a little chip that talks to your phone that allows you to make a donation there and then on your phone using Apple Pay. So the advancements in terms of fundraising really are helping us. And I think COVID has actually, in a kind of a strange way, driven a lot of improvements, and it certainly created a need for us all to be agile and to be early adopters of new technology. But you know, if you're a community, or you're a football team, or you're a bridge club, or you're a cycling club, or anything like that, or you're a family and you do some fundraising every year, you know, while we're based here in North Cork, that's just because where we're based, we're actually a service for the people of Munster, and we just want people to understand that. So we're as much a charity of County Clare as we are of Kerry or Cork or Limerick or Waterford or anywhere else we would go. So what we would ask people to do is, if there's an opportunity to support us, please do that. And, you know, if they want to find out further information about us, they can go to our website, which is communityairambulance.ie. I wish you could swim like dolphins.